The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix Podcast. Tune in today.
Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Tēnā koutou katoa, this is Toby Manhire with Gone by Lunchtime. Absent today, your friends and mine, Ben Thomas and Annabelle Lee Mather. We will return to normal service very soon. But a special episode today, Grant Robertson departed recently the Houses of Parliament after a long career as a Labour MP, Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister. He started, of course, as a parliamentary staffer back in the day in the offices of Marion Hobbs and then Helen Clark, where he became known as H3, and eventually was elected as the MP for Wellington Central and onwards and upwards and from there. After his valedictory speech the other week on Wednesday, March 27, I got together with him at the Basin Reserve cricket ground because we'd conducted an interview there some many years before, and so it was a way of bookending of a sort. We sat down in the great R.A. Vance stand just above the change rooms there at the end of Kent Terrace and talked about the difficult last election year, the tax switch that wasn't, about the COVID response and whether or not that made the rich richer. We talked a bit about why his grandchildren call him GG and also sought to find a place of accord between him and Chris Bishop on one of the most important questions facing the nation. Oh, obviously because we're sitting at the cricket, you can hear a bit of the cricket. If you don't like the sound of cricket, then I don't know what's wrong with you. I can't help you, but maybe another podcast will work. So forgive a few little tidy snips and edits to remove the sound of the most obtrusive bits. Here we are at the Basin Reserve with Grant Robertson, the former MP.
Yes.
You're now a former MP.
Former MP as of 11:59 Friday night last week.
And I've got a test to assess the extent to which you have decompressed from that yet. What did you make the budget policy statement as well?
Came out today. Yeah. I have had one text message about it and I have not read it. I've read the text message, but I haven't read the budget policy statement yet. So, but I feel like I will end up reading it, so I'm being a bit of a fraud. Okay. I think I will read it later.
But that's progress. That's progress.
Yeah, but I didn't try and watch it live or anything like that.
That would have been the tragic
thing. I was
thing.
Here, so.
We're watching the White Ferns. Struggling a bit in the second innings against England.
They are, unfortunately. They need about 10 and over from here, which will be tough.
You recently completed a very important job, being the sports minister.
That's correct. The most important, yep.
And are you willing to go on the record and agree with your successor as sports minister, Chris Bishop, on the point that the Basin Reserve is the home of New Zealand cricket?
I think I am. I think there is bipartisan agreement in this instance. I mean, I've watched a lot of cricket everywhere around New Zealand, and on a good day here at the Basin with the grass banks and all of that. Mm. I tell you, Hagley is a beautiful ground too.
Sure.
But
it's not the home of cricket, though.
It's not the home of cricket. And of course, because Auckland doesn't really have a cricket venue, we get to do that.
That's
a good
shot.
We've just watched
One bounce for four.
Brooke Halliday put that into one bounce for four in the mid-wicket area.
Still on cricket.
Yes.
Last time, one of the reasons that we're meeting here is because I interviewed you a long time ago when you were the
opposition finance spokesperson
at the Basin Reserve.
Yep.
and New Zealand were playing, I forget who.
Was it Sri Lanka? I feel like it might have been Sri Lanka.
And I asked you if you were a member of the New Zealand cricket team, who would you be?
God, what did I say?
And immodestly, you said somewhere between Ross Taylor and Kane Williamson.
That's outstanding. I obviously had ambition.
And so the question now would be, which white fern would you identify with?
Well, I think I have to identify with a retired white fern, don't I? So probably Katie Martin.
There goes another worker. Yeah, Katie Martin. She's transferred into a thriving career
as a commentator, as an
expert. Is that your plan?
No, actually, it isn't.
I suppose your new employer at Otago University wouldn't be too heavy with you popping up on
nightstand
politics.
No. What? No, I mean, punditry in politics is an interesting thing, isn't it? Like, I think we need it, you know?
Yeah.
And the left, I think we sometimes feel that we're a bit underserved, you know, that some of the media outlets have a few more right-wing commentators than they do left-wing ones, but sadly, that won't be me. Not for at least the next five years.
The right say the same thing, though, don't
Yeah,
they?
I guess so.
Before you start your role, not as a political pundit, but as Vice Chancellor of Otago University, your alma mater, what are you going to do in between?
So we've got to pack our house up, and so we've got 21 years worth of rubbish to deal with, and then end of April, beginning of May, we're off overseas for a holiday, which will be fantastic, to give myself a bit of distance from one job before I take the next one, and yeah, start off in Dunedin on the 1st of July.
You excited about that? It's been a bit of pushback, like not an academic.
Yeah, that was pretty expected though, wasn't it? I mean, there hasn't been a non-academic in the Vice-Chancellor's role ever in the 154 years, so I think that had to be expected. And maybe a little bit of, you know, can I make the transition out of politics into this, but I've got a pretty long history with Otago, and I like to think of myself, to use a Jacinda Ardernism, as academic adjacent. The crowd aren't clapping that very good joke. They're clapping a boundary.
A tidy tuck around the corner for four. because we're at the base of the reserve, there are 10 ambulances tearing down Adelaide Road.
That's right, getting stuck in the traffic, so that'll be really noisy. This is great. I'm loving this. It's very authentic.
It's a true basin experience.
Keep going.
You gave your valedictory last week to a full house, and all that was emotional, it was moving. One of the things that you said was, New Zealand's tax system is unfair and unbalanced. Did you think about whether to say that or not, or did you need to say that?
I felt like I needed to say it. I mean, you know, it's no secret to anybody that I have had a couple of cracks at trying to address the unfairness and the lack of balance, both, you know, when we worked on a CGT when we were in government with New Zealand First and the Greens, and then latterly in the package that David Parker and I were working on. So circumstances conspired to mean that those two efforts didn't succeed, but it doesn't change my view on that. And Chris Hipkins spoke a little bit about that in his speech that he gave on Sunday, you know, and I think, you know, there has to be action in that space. And I don't know, you've got to be upfront about these things. You give a speech about all the wonderful things you've done or whatever. I felt like it was important to talk about something that I wanted to do but I didn't get to.
Yeah, and so you're right, Chris Hipkins came out and expressed sentiments suggesting there needed to be a change, structural change and so forth. You almost think, if only you guys had had a majority government for 3 years.
Yeah, and as I say, I had a plan that that was heading in that direction. Obviously, Jacinda had made some comments about what she was prepared to do and not prepared to do, and we had to work our way through that. We wanted to get it right. I felt like we were heading in the right direction. Chris didn't, and he was the leader, and I think we had to respect that. So, yeah. The 3 years of majority government was definitely a period where I felt we could make that change, but we just didn't quite get there in the end.
And if you were offering genuinely non-partisan advice to future politicians, would you say go comprehensive capital gains tax or wealth tax or a bit of both? Or?
I think both are doable. And as I said in my valedictory speech, it's not really me anymore that gets to decide that. But I think both, put it this way, both would make a difference to that fairness question. Obviously a CGT is a more known quantity. There are more of them in existence around the world, but they also come with exemptions and exclusions and things. A wealth tax is less tried, but does take to the super wealthy, for whom you feel that there really is a gap in what they're paying. So I think either would be doable, and either would be a really good start to addressing some of the issues we've got.
You touched on Jacinda Ardern basically saying she would resign if she did the same thing that, you know, John Key did on changing the age of super.
Yeah.
You know, Nicola Willis recently said she'd resign, or was encouraged to say and said she'd resign if she didn't introduce the tax cuts. What do you think about that generally? Generally speaking, it's I mean, we in the media are probably responsible to a degree, but I understand it's a kind of inoculation process.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I think, objectively, I don't love it, you know? I think that sort of absolute, you know, I will resign if I do this, or, you know, you should resign if you don't do that. It's hard. I mean, I used to call it the rule-in, rule-out game as a version of that, which TV3 were the greatest protagonists of, you know? Mm. And it's just, you know, what, you know, life keeps moving, and if somehow or other, if you don't say you're going to rule in or rule out something, it creates this story, so you almost feel like you've got to do it, and then once you do it, you know, that becomes a thing that gets hung around your neck. So I don't love it. I think politics is fluid and dynamic, and sometimes you will be able to do things, will not be able to do things that you wanted and set out to do.
Mm.
But you know, it's up to politicians to either say yes or no to that, isn't it?
That year and that last year, oh, it's a lovely lofted off drive.
For Calladay, well done.
Down to the fence for four runs. That last year, in which you had a crack, you and David Parker and maybe some others put forward the wealth tax, the tax switch as it was conceived. That year, how hard was it? Because it was, you decided after Jacinda Ardern said that she was going to step away, you'd thought about it and thought, no, I'm not going to go for leader. And you've talked about that various times. So then you decided to stick it out, though. You wanted to be there and you wanted to push through the election. Income insurance, which was one of your grandchildren, babies, whatever, thrown on the proverbial bonfire. The tax switch was jettisoned from Lithuania or something like that, I think. I can't remember where the statement came from. You had to swallow a dead beetroot-flavoured rat, boondoggle-flavoured rat on the fruit. Yep. That must have been all tough time to wade through.
I mean, it wasn't great, eh? But on the flip side, I think right now, watching what the government's doing, is the very reason why, despite those things not going the way I wanted them to, I still was there to fight, because there was a lot more to fight for than just those policies. In the case of both of them, essentially the major ones, the tax and the income insurance, I feel like they will have their day. Eventually people will think we need to have something more comprehensive for a big economic shock when people lose their jobs, and the tax one, I'm convinced that that will happen as well. So timing is everything in politics, and in the end my timing was probably a bit off on those particular areas, but I still believe in them and I still think they're important. It's important work.
Was there any moment in the course of that year when you think, maybe I should have just, because it was right there for you to go, okay, I'll be leader up to the election, I'll give it a whirl, I'll be Prime Minister.
I thought about it. I thought about the taking the job, and then it was a very difficult year, 2023. The people underestimate just how impactful the cyclones and the Auckland anniversary weekend floods were. Obviously the people that happened to don't underestimate that, they know what happened to their lives, but from a political perspective it was really, really difficult. And I was probably, one thing in on reflection, Chris asked me to be the cyclone recovery minister because it was so challenging. We were bringing all these different agencies together and doing all of these things, and not having that role made the year really, really challenging. In many ways felt that was probably one of the tougher bits, was had all that going on, plus I was trying to do the cyclone thing. And it was a big year, but I stand by the decision. I knew I didn't have inside me what I knew the job required, and I was happy to carry on and support Chris and hopefully get us another term. But no, I don't regret the decision.
The Cyclones, you're right, were so huge and impactful. And we talked about this on the podcast, but I remember writing that this is going to last all the way into the election. That's not far away. It will be an important part of the election debate. I was wrong.
Yeah.
I was dead wrong. It wasn't really.
No, it wasn't.
In
a funny way, I think it's because we did handle it okay. Mm. You know, that we actually did the things that we needed to do. We got money into those areas.
I guess I'm talking as much about the more macro picture of the role that climate played in that, which wasn't entirely a climate change event, whatever. That it was, because it's now a material,
I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, I feel like people's decisions about elections, you know, every person are going to be driven by different things, but the cost of living, crime, that stuff was just so much bigger. And that's a ridiculous thing to say, because climate is obviously bigger than all of those things. But in people's immediate lives and experiences, it was bigger. And because the weather events could be geographically kind of put there, that allowed other people not to really worry about them. So, and I think we dealt with them about as well as we could, but yeah, very hard. I mean, but an election like that, I mean, I said this in an interview the other day, that even if we'd got that tax policy through, I still don't think we would have won the election. I think the tide was going out, and that was...
You knew that the tide was going out?
I think, you know, through the middle of the campaign, we just weren't making ground, and we were just too far behind. And you just... It's really interesting. I've had elections, either as a volunteer or a candidate, where people won't look you in the eye, and they won't... You know, and you know you're going to lose. It wasn't one of those. Like, people were quite almost sympathetic to us, you know. They were like... And there was... I don't know if I told the story. Yes, I did in one interview, but... I knocked on the door up in Karori of a woman who was lovely and really nice, and then at the end she said, well, I'm not going to vote for you guys. And I said, oh, would you mind me asking why not? And she said, oh, well, you've had 9 years. I know it's felt like that. It has for all of us. But,
yeah.
You know,
well, I think we talked about this a little bit when I invited up to the election, that I think of it as a concertina government, because it at once... felt like 9 years in lots of ways, but you had 3 years actual government work, you know. That's not to, you know, that's not to make a judgment on it either way, except it was weird. Time worked in a weird way.
And I did, so I just feel like, yeah. So, I mean, you know, in that you always fight hard in an election campaign because that's who we are, but it doesn't mean when you're lying in bed at the end of a long day's campaigning, you aren't sitting there thinking, well, that's probably not going to happen for us now.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
And COVID was the thing, of course, the big thing that, you know, lurched up and changed everything. And when you look back at that, you obviously had to act fast. You made decisions that put money into people's pocket, kept the economy going. You faced potential prognostications of high unemployment, all that sort of stuff. So fine. But there's also that, oh, is that out? It's going to be caught on the long on boundary.
It is. Had to be done.
New Zealand's chasing the game. And it's probably gone now, this game.
Well, the only thing is with the Sophie Devine, can just stand there on one leg and swing.
So apparently she can't come in until we're five down because she was off the field
for too long.
During the fielding.
She can now come in.
Oh, sorry, 25. Oh, that's good and bad.
Yeah.
The COVID thing, there was the concerns were the K-shaped recovery, you know, where the Yeah. And some of that is what happened, and you know, with the property owning class ended up sucking up a lot of that money.
Yeah, I mean they did, and but that is because of the nature of the New Zealand economy. So the unless we did an intervention that fundamentally changed the nature of the New Zealand economy, the people who were in a strong position were going to do well. So in a sense, in your introduction to that question, you talked about us, you know, we were trying to hold still. We were trying to make sure that people kept their jobs, that businesses stayed afloat. And as a result of that, the status quo got expanded almost. And so because the Reserve Bank, they do make their decisions independently about what they're going to do, and they kept, you know, they kept using the one tool they've got, and they injected money supply into the economy. The banks then lent that money in the same way that they always lend money, largely to property. So in the absence of an intervention that undid that very, very deep-seated structure of the New Zealand economy, that was one possible result. And I've been asked, and I think it was Thomas Coughlin asked me the other day, you know, would there have been another intervention? And yeah, potentially there would have, you know, that we could have said that certain parts of the money that was being injected into the economy could be only used for particular asset classes, so maybe not for property. Mm-hmm. But that isn't a decision that I got to make. That's a decision that the Reserve Bank would have had to have made, and it would have been a quite deep interference in the retail banking sector had they done sort of directed them more closely as to where that money could go. So I accept it. I accept that there was property values did inflate. Again, we were in the unknown. We had no idea what was going to happen, and we were trying to cover all our bases. And ultimately, when I put the scorecard together at the end, I'm happy with what we did.
Mm. And if that's such a fundamental kind of structural issue with the economy, per B. Hickey, a housing market with some bits stuck on, is a capital gains tax the sort of thing that fixes that, or is there something more fundamental still that?
It certainly helps. I mean, I guess the thing that it doesn't necessarily address is other ways that New Zealand economy becomes more productive, other ways that higher wage jobs get created. But certainly
housing supply.
And housing supply, which will always be the biggest determinant. But it will certainly help, or you know, whichever version of an asset or wealth tax will certainly help address those issues. Yeah.
In terms of the whole delivery piece, you know, and the old year of delivery, which was, can't remember which one that was. it was one where there wasn't all that much delivery, if I recall correctly. What happened to the implementation unit you set up? Did that ever bear fruit?
It was useful. So in the end, the way it ended up working was that we used it to look at some programs that we had going, social housing, various things, and just try and understand where they were at with what perhaps could be tweaked in order to make them deliver better. I think we did a review of it at the end, and everybody involved in it thought it was useful. I guess what it wasn't probably quite getting to with some of those bigger issues, like why doesn't infrastructure get built in New Zealand more quickly and more efficiently and more effectively. It was good on it at a program level for tweaking programs, but not perhaps up at some of those bigger issues. And then the other thing is that we, quite deliberately in a way, we had a thing called the Cabinet Priorities Committee, and that met once a month and went through kind of all the things we'd said were part of our program. And the implementation unit did sort of deep dives. I think I understand the current government might be looking at almost flipping that around and having the implementation unit more involved in the political priorities, which is a bit more like how Tony Blair originally...
The deliverology. There was a Thomas Manch piece about that the other day, which was interesting.
Yeah. So I think maybe they might be looking at it.
Do you think that's a good idea?
I think it's an interesting idea and probably might be more politically effective, potentially,
It feels as though there's something that needs to be unlocked. And you were very complimentary about the public service. Good on you, in the valedictory speech. Is there something in that machine that needs unlocking?
Oh, God, yes. And that was more the other part. And I had to take this out of my speech, actually, because I did write a whole section on what is constraining the public service. And without going into all the gory details of it, we need to break the silos down more effectively. And unfortunately, the public finance act and the public sector act still have everything in silos, is what are called appropriations in the public finance world, and getting agencies to collaborate, work together, focus on what the actual outcome you're looking for is, the problem you're trying to solve, and realising that multiple agencies have a role. We do that, climate change is an example, but I don't know that we do it very effectively, and the money side of it is not well set up. I started to reform that, and again, it's one of those kind of works in progress, which I really do hope carries on.
Public service is one thing. The other part, the bolted on bit, is the consultant sector, if there's such a thing. And you see it physically with the growth of the buildings, you know, surrounding the
Beehive.
Yeah. I mean, amazing.
PwC.
Did that get a bit out of control?
I think it probably, I don't know about it out of control, but it grew, and it grew significantly because Labor governments will always do this. We wanted to do a lot of things. You know, we had major structural changes happening in health, vocational education, water, you know, and there just isn't the capacity in the public sector to take all of that on all in one go. So you invariably use consultants to get that extra work done more quickly. COVID obviously was a big factor for that, because we simply didn't have the people we needed there. So, yeah, I think it grew because we were doing so much. Having said that, as a kind of percentage of government spend, it actually was starting to trend down. So, and we had our eye on that because we could see that there was, you know, we wanted more full-time capacity in the agencies. Charlotte.
Look at that. That's four runs. Played out to school.
I think it's a really interesting thing because you do want some people you can call on for particular projects. But as I say, we recognise that it was starting to trend down. The current government say they're going to bring it down. I think the more full-time public servants they let go, the more when they actually do try to do something, maybe their plan is to do nothing as a government, but if their plan is to actually do things, then they too will find that they need staff to do that.
You mentioned COVID and the period where more people came on board, and leaving to one side what happened in the Beehive, maybe an echo of what happened in the Beehive was the real talent in the public service came together and moved into new floors and whatever building it was.
I totally believe that. And I think that is, so the public, we made some changes to the Public Finance Act and the public, we called it the Public Service Act, and that actually allows for more integration. So we've done that now in family and domestic violence, we're doing it a little bit in climate change, where we do bring people from different agencies physically together as well as in terms of their work load. And you know, I do think the world's messy and complex problems need us to look quite differently at the way we structure and organise that.
In your valedictory, as another ambulance enters the world's greatest roundabout, you gave particular moving shout-outs to three people that, I mean, among others, but there was Alf.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about him.
The love of my life. We've been together for 25 years. He's not a person, as I said in the speech, he's not a person who loves politics. In fact, you know, borderline actively dislikes it. But he's been an amazing part of my life, and yeah, you know, I owe him so much for having supported me, and it'll be good to spend a bit more time together over the next little while. I've got a family, and built family out of Alpha with his two kids and now our four grandchildren, and yeah, it's been amazing.
GG, apparently.
Granddad Grant. It was because Alf unbelievably convinced his granddaughters to call him G Diddy. And so they, you know how kids are, like they, you know, like that's just what they called him. So it was G Diddy and GG. So.
Critical question.
Yeah.
Has Alf ever lived in Dunedin?
No. But after 25 years of visiting, and I just want to say he's as keen as I am.
Really?
Down here. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, we might have to buy him an extra extra jersey.
You need to get underfloor heating or something. I think that's you're in some mansion, aren't you? Getting paid.
I don't think
it's a crazy amount of money. $600,000 a year.
Spending a lot of the university's money.
Grant Robertson scholarship with some of that money.
Oh, there's definitely. I've got some ideas about some things I can do. Yeah, I mean, I'm conscious of the salary I'm getting, and there are definitely some areas I want to support students, particularly, and so I'll be looking to do that when I get down there.
Your dad.
Yep.
That was I mean, for people who have read your stories about your childhood, he was a dearly loved figure who also had made a mistake at a certain point in his life.
A bit more than a mistake, yeah. I mean, he went to prison for theft as a servant from the law firm that he worked at, and he stole a significant amount of money from them over a long period of time. And yeah, it was, you know, he was. I loved him, but he was a deeply flawed man as well, and a hard thing to deal with at the time, obviously. You know, but he was 17, 18 years out of prison when he died, and so obviously his life had moved on, and it was really sad to not have him around for a lot longer.
Was that quite a formative experience?
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
I mean, Longy's father ended up going through a court process for something that he was ultimately exonerated on, but that was obviously it kind of woke something up in him about the world, about justice. I don't know. Was it something like that?
Almost
for you?
Had the opposite effect on me, right? Because I was a law student. I was trying to get into law school at the time. I actually got in, but decided not to take it up.
Is that right?
Not entirely, but partly because of the experience of going through that legal system with Dad. Yeah, it was. I mean, the time I spent visiting him in prison was hugely formative to me around my views around what we use prisons for, and whether they're of a great deal of use for a lot of the people who end up in them, and also just what it meant economically for me and my family. I mean, hugely significant.
And your mum? I bumped into you one day when I was with my sister and my parents, and we were driving through Central Otago.
Right. Yeah.
I can't remember. Maybe it was Lawrence.
It was Lawrence.
Like that.
Yeah.
And you were finance minister at the time, but you'd flown down for the night, I guess, to
I
see your mum on her birthday.
Oh no, it was her birthday. You're absolutely right. It was her birthday. Yeah. That's right.
And so, I mean, you know, there's obviously a real closeness there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as I said in the speech, I mean, you know, I have spent a lifetime trying to match my mother in a way. Like, she's an extraordinary person in so many ways, intellectually, compassionately, just as a person generally. And yeah, I've got two brothers who both live overseas, and so for a long time I've been the one here in New Zealand, so I think that's also led me to keep close with mum. And you know, a lot of the value basis that I have and that my brothers have, and that comes from mum, it comes from her outlook on the world, and she's still very interested politically and not a fan of the limelight, so I've tried not to talk about it too much until the end.
You'd said in the speech, though, that now you'll be able to complain about the government
we'll
together.
Both be able to complain about the government.
So maybe if you're not available for punditry, it's her turn.
She would make a fantastic political pundit. I'm not sure the shorter form would be good for her, but but no.
Kia ora e te iwi. Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.